alliance proved very beneficial to the Western Turks. By the time that the Shah surrendered, actually Khusrau II was overthrown. There were a succession of very weak and short-lived Shahs that followed him. The Turks actually worked off with the lion's share of the territorial gains. They gained control of Transoxiana. So when the Muslim armies, the armies, Arabic armies under the banner of Islam, overthrow the Persian Empire and penetrate to the Oxus River, all of Transoxiana is under the protection of the Turkish Khan, the Khan of the Western Turks. And that will have significant consequences for the interaction of the Islamic world under the Arab caliphs and the Turkish nomads. The other great benefit they gained was access to those strategic passes in the Caucasus. And this actually was quite acceptable to Constantinople. Those passes allowed Turkish armies to enter Armenia and enter Iran. Armenia was a land of Christian kingdoms, but they were seen by the Byzantine emperor as heretics, as Monophysites, and often making common cause with the Persian Shah or later with the Arab caliph. So it did not trouble the Byzantine emperor that these passes were in the hands of Turkish allies. And so throughout the 7th, 8th, and 9th century, the territorial ambitions of these Western Turks more or less corresponded with the territorial aims of the Byzantine emperors. Both of them had common cause to fear the Sassanid Shahs. Well, in 634, Arab armies crossed the imperial frontiers of Syria. These areas had just passed back under imperial control after that exhausting war with Persia some 4 years earlier. The Arab armies cut up an imperial force. Initially, the Emperor Heraclius, who was extremely ill and incapacitated, he could not lead the imperial armies, simply dismissed this as another typical raid by Arab nomads. And actually, for centuries, the Romans had regarded the frontier with the Arabians as a minor frontier. One Roman emperor, Trajan Decius, reputedly argued that you want to check Arab raiders along the desert frontier, simply increase the lion population. That'll do the job for you. The Romans were far more concerned with Persia, far more concerned with the northern steppes. Well, these raids escalated into the Islamic conquests. What the Byzantines didn't know, and what the Persians didn't know, is that the Arab army, starting in 636, under the banner of Islam, would carry out some of the most spectacular military conquests in human history. They would overthrow the Sassanid Empire. They would overrun Syria, Egypt, North Africa. All of the wealthy southern and eastern provinces of the Roman Emperor of Constantinople would now be incorporated with Arabia and Iran into a new world empire called the Caliphate. We will discuss the implications of those invasions and successes in a future lecture. What is significant for us to know at the moment is that the emergence, the dramatic emergence of Arabic power under first the Rashidun caliphs, the first four rightful caliphs down to 661, and then the Umayyad caliphs, who ruled as dynastic monarchs, essentially, in the city of Damascus from 661 down to 750, that the emergence of this powerful Muslim Arabic state drew the Western Turks and the Byzantines close together. The Western Turks had also reconfigured themselves in the early 7th century. It is a bit obscure what happened, but several important developments resulted in the Khans of the Western Turks going their own separate ways from their eastern kinsmen. In 657, a Tang army operating out of the Tarim Basin inflicted a decisive defeat on the Western Turks north of the Jaxartes River. And from 657 to 681, the Western Khan, actually the subordinate Khan, he would have probably been called Yabgu, Yabgu Khan, acknowledged the authority of the Tang Emperor. And that led to a fragmenting of the Western Khanate. And there is a complicated succession of civil wars, reconfederations of the tribes. Eventually, they are reconfederated into something known as the On Ok, the Ten Arrows. And in 670, one of the leading tribes out of this confederation, the Khazars emerge as the dominant tribe occupying the steppes, essentially around the Aral Sea and down to the borders of Persia. The Khazars were one of the 10 inner tribes of this confederacy. Their Khan was recognized as supreme. He made claims of being a descendant of the Ashina clan, that is the family of the original Khans who overthrew the Avars. And they were able to make their claims stick for several reasons. One is the Eastern Khanate was long under Chinese domination. It reasserted itself. It went a separate path. The central steppes, where there were a number of Turkish tribes, they became locked into a struggle with the Arab caliphate over the cities of Transoxiana. So the steppes stretching essentially from the Aral Sea into southeastern Europe, those steppes were left essentially free of outside influence, and the Khazars could exercise their power over a wide range of different tribes, and eventually brought them into a typical confederation of inner and outer tribes. The inner tribes being the tribes of the Khazars, the immediate family of the Khan, who was revered as a celestial figure, almost as a nomadic version of the Emperor of China, and a ritual figure. And in addition, the Khan became such an important religious figure that he designated administrative and military affairs to a subordinate. And that subordinate we encounter is a man who is usually designated as a bek, or bey, as you would say in modern Turkish. And so starting from the 670s and 680s, a new Turkish power began to emerge on the steppes between the Caspian Sea and the Volga region, and they expanded their sway westward over sundry tribes of the lower Dnieper, Don River, and eventually their power was felt as far as the Hungarian and Wallachian grasslands in Eastern Europe. The Khazars enjoyed an unusually close relationship with the Byzantine emperors. As the Khazars were reconfiguring themselves into the next great confederacy on the steppes in the 670s, Constantinople was in the battle for her life. Not only did they have to deal with Avars in the Balkans, Slavs settling in their Balkan provinces, but they were under constant attack by the Arab caliphs of Damascus. Twice the city of Constantinople was besieged in 674, 677, again in 718, both times the Arab armies were beaten back. Shortly after that second siege, the Emperor Leo III initiated a debate over why is the empire suffering defeats. He concluded it was because people were worshiping icons as if they were idols. Those are icons in Orthodox worship. He wanted the icons removed. And for the next several generations, from 626, when his edict was published, removing the icons, down to the restoration of icons in 843, the Byzantine Empire is in a veritable civil war over the use of icons in religious worship. Well, under these circumstances, with an empire under constant assault by a greater caliphate, with an empire whose control over the Italian peninsula and the Balkans has been shattered, compliments of the Avars, the Khazar Khans represent a godsend of an alliance. And these alliances went back to the reign of Heraclius, and they were repeatedly cemented through the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries. The Byzantines actually departed from their Roman legal practices and carried out alliances with the Khazars that would have been unthinkable in the earlier Roman periods. We know of marriage alliances. This is very, very unusual. The Emperor Heraclius considered marrying one of his daughters to a Khazar Khan. He's called in the sources Zibel. We're not exactly sure who he is. It's hard to match this source in literary sources with known Turkish names. Nonetheless, it was seriously considered. That type of marriage was impossible at the time of Attila the Hun. We know of several other marriage alliances. One of the most colorful ones is of the Emperor Justinian II. He was autocratic even by Byzantine standards. He had two reigns, one from 685 to 695. He was overthrown in 695 because of his autocratic and erratic policies. And in keeping with Byzantine policy, he was disfigured. He had his nose slit. And so he's known in the sources as Justinian Rhinomatis, the slit nose. And what the emperor did is he had a gold nose made up that he attached to hide his disfigurement. And he was sent in exile to Sherzan, that is the port on the Crimea, which is the main port by which the Byzantine court communicates with the Khazars, who have their court at the city of Atil at the mouth of the Volga on the Caspian Sea. Justinian II manages to escape. He makes his way to the Khazar court. The Khan is really impressed by Justinian. First, they're fellow autocrats. They can get along that way. They have a lot of items they can share, like how to oppress your subjects. The second thing they had in common is the disfigurement. The Khan probably thought the slit nose was actually neat. There's all kinds of ritual deformity of heads on the steps, cutting, tattooing, body art. So he gave his sister in marriage to Justinian and gave him an army to recover his throne. Justinian recovered his throne, proved just as autocratic as before, was overthrown, and this time he was not disfigured, he was beheaded and ended his career. We know of a later marriage between the Emperor Constantine V and a Khazar princess known as Chichik. That's how I would render the Greek word. It means flower. She's, of course, renamed with a Greek name, Irene. And the son of that union, Leo IV, became Emperor of Constantinople. There's constant diplomatic exchanges. Apparently, the Byzantine court is very, very impressed by the Khazar court. It represented a great power, a great confederacy on the steppes, and it was in alliance against the caliphate. It is still a debated issue how this came about, but in the 8th and 9th centuries, several Byzantine emperors were selected by a beauty pageant. Now, it sounds a little silly to us, but the idea was that the emperor was so great, he should be served by the most beautiful woman in the world. He was the vice regent of Christ, and these beauty contests were held. They were clearly rigged. I mean, generally, the dowager empress, mom, or in the case of one of them, stepmom, in the case of the Emperor Theophilus, had the answers all prepared. There was a question and answer session. But this type of pageantry, this type of selection, was apparently characteristic of the Khazar court. We have comments about that, particularly by Arab sources. And it seems to be a practice that was adopted by the Byzantines in part in imitation of the Khazar court. And it makes sense. The Khazar Khan came to be a ruler virtually in the guise of a Chinese emperor. He was the son of heaven. He was the celestial Khan, the Gurk Khan, the Sky Khan. He was so busy with religious rites and matters that he had no time for mundane things like fighting Arabs or dealing with other types of trade missions and the like. And therefore, this Khazar practice apparently was adopted by Constantinople and is a very, very telling incident of the relationship between the two courts. Now, from a practical military viewpoint, the Khazars proved to be invaluable allies. They were able to field large armies of cavalry and periodically could cross either the Dariel Pass or the Derbent Pass and invade the caliphate directly, taking pressure off the Byzantine emperor. In addition, the caliphs decided that the conquest of the Khazars was probably as significant as the conquest of Rum, that is the Byzantine Empire, and Arab armies repeatedly crossed the Caucasus in attempt to bring the Khazars to battle and defeat them. Here, the Umayyad caliphs ran into the same problems that the early Persian kings and the Sassanid kings encountered, that is, bringing horse archers, steppe horse archers, to battle. And in these early encounters, both against the Khazars and then against their Turkish kinsmen in Transoxiana, the Arab authors, the Arab chroniclers, already are stating in the early 8th century that the Turks on horseback can outride and outshoot Arabs. They're really that good. In 737, the future Caliph Marwan leads an army across the Caucasus, defeats the Khazars, and forces a conversion to Islam. We're not sure exactly what this means. Marwan went on to be one of the last caliphs of the Umayyad dynasty. He actually moved the capital from Damascus to Haran, which is not one of his better moves, though he did build a very nice mosque there, which survives in ruins. And that defeat and forced conversion was immediately repudiated. And sometime after, at the end of the 8th or the beginning of the early 9th century, the Khazar court embraced Judaism. Many had accepted for a long time, including myself, the late date of 860. But the discovery of coins, imitative coins, that is, coins issued by the Khazars, apparently in imitation of Muslim coins, suggests that the date is a generation or two earlier. These are very rare coins, still to be published fully, found in a hoard in Gotland in Scandinavia. And what they show is a modification of the Arab coin where the prophet is substituted with the name Musa, Moses. And there is enough change in the iconography to indicate that the monotheistic religion being proclaimed is not Islam, but Judaism. Well, how did this come about? Well, one of the great achievements of the Khazars is their promotion of trade, the development of trade along this northern extension of the Silk Road. I mentioned the trade routes skirting the Aral and Caspian Sea and heading to the Greek ports on the Black Sea, bringing in silk and other objects. Well, what was traded in exchange? Not just the products of the Roman world, but also the products of the forest. That is the amber coming from the Baltic. Various types of furs, big trade in furs, coming ultimately from the Arctic. But above all, slaves, usually Slavic peoples who've been enslaved and are being sold as labor into the Islamic world. Another commodity will be Turks. Turks who are captured in raids, young men between the ages of essentially 14 and 18, who are then sold into the Islamic world to become soldiers. And we'll discuss the emergence of slave armies when we turn to the Caliphate in one of the upcoming lectures. And so the Khazars exploited all these trade networks. The movement of goods within the early Islamic empire was usually in the hands of minorities, especially trade goods across the Mediterranean. Several groups emerged in prominence, foremost the Jews. Jewish bankers and trading houses literally extended from Muslim Spain across North Africa to Egypt and Syria. There were big communities in Cordova and Cairo, and we found some remarkable documents, the so-called Geniza documents in a synagogue in medieval Cairo, in old Cairo, that gives us a sense of the extent and range of Jewish merchandising and banking. And they succeeded to the same banking mercantile practices I described earlier on the Silk Road. And it's almost certain that these Jews were very, very prominent at the Khazar capital at Atil. Muslim sources report them in great numbers. And the Khazar Khan, probably in the late 700s or early 800s, decided that this was a worthy monotheistic religion. It wasn't Orthodox Christianity. It wasn't Islam. It marked the Khanate as a separate great state. And the court converted to Judaism, just as the Uyghurs, that is their eastern kinsmen, who established the great Khanate in the Mongolian homeland at the time, on the eastern steppes, embraced Manichaeism. It was a sensible option. And with the conversion of Judaism came enormous advantages. We have a very, very good account of the journey of a Muslim geographer and historian named Ibn Fadlan, who traveled in 921-922 to the Volga. He was really invited there to attend the court of the Bulgar Khan of the Volga. These were Bulgar kinsmen of the ones who had settled in the Balkans. They're not to be confused with their kinsmen who eventually become Bulgarians and Orthodox Christians. They were on the middle Volga. They were subjects of the Khazar Khan. And in 921, 922, they converted to Islam, and they had petitioned the caliph for envoys and for teachers in the new faith. And Ibn Fadlan traveled there. Well, he also passed through Atil, the Khazar court, the capital. And he makes comment of the numbers of Jews, Christians, and Muslims trading in the city. The fact that there were so many people of these nationalities that special courts had to be set up to adjudicate questions of contract and commerce, and these would be mixed courts. He was also impressed by the extent of the slave trade, as well as the powers of the Khan, how he ruled as a virtual celestial figure, and he notes the fact that the Khanate is a confederation of different tribes, and so much wealth is pouring into Atil, the capital, because of the trade connections. And this is one of the great genius of the Khazar Khans. They tolerated all the faiths. They encouraged trade routes. They turned what was originally a tent city, Atil, into a great commercial settlement at the mouth of the Volga, something that really began to resemble a true city. Now, for all of this success, the question comes up, where did they go wrong? In my opinion, the Khazar Khans had constructed the most successful confederacy on the western steppes until the Golden Horde of the Mongols. It was light years ahead of the Scythians and the Sarmatians, and was going to be quite far more sophisticated from the Pecheneks and Cumans who would follow them. Well, the problem was that the Khans spent so much of their time on trade and commerce and the benefits of the material culture from the higher civilizations that they failed to enforce their will over the subject tribes. And this led to challenges within their own confederacy. There were two tribes who will come to play a very important role in the upcoming lecture. One of them were the Magyars. They are not Turkish speakers. They're actually speaking a language known as Finno-Ugrian, which is a language related to Finnish and Estonian today. They were people of the forests who had moved onto the western steppes and had adopted a pastoral way of life, and they proved very rambunctious and unruly vassals of the Khan, the Khazar Khan, and they ended up migrating westward into Eastern Europe, got involved in the Byzantine-Bulgarian Wars, and were eventually sent ricocheting into Hungary, where they settled and became the Magyars and the Hungarians we know in 897. In the meanwhile, on their route to their final destination, they did quite a job in disrupting the Khan's control of his subject tribes. Another one were the Pecheneks, another unruly group of members of the Khanate who came to dominate the South Russian steppes, that is, the areas around the Don and the Dnieper River. And the Pecheneks entered into an alliance with a third group of people who were total interlopers. These were the Rus, Scandinavians from Sweden, who since the 8th century had been exploiting the trade route on the Volga, and especially were active in the slave trade, and were operating as merchant princes by permission in the Khazar Khanate. Well, when the Pecheneks in the early 9th century came to dominate the South Russian steppes and were at loggerheads with their overlords, the Khazar Khans, the Rus, or the Scandinavians, switched the axis of their trade from the Volga to the Dnieper. They established cities at the future Russian towns of Novgorod and Kiev. They aligned their trade route on Constantinople and entered into alliance with the Pecheneks. And this Pechenek-Rus alliance undermined a good deal of the trade routes that had previously gone to Atil. And both the Pecheneks and Rus came to see the Khazars as foes, and for various reasons, some of it perhaps religious, the emperor in Constantinople came to prefer the Pecheneks and Rus as allies over the Khazars. In part, the caliphate was in decline, the Khazars weren't so important, the Khazars had reconverted to Judaism, and furthermore, the Rus, particularly, these Scandinavian warriors who arrived in Constantinople by sea, proved to be excellent soldiers, were recruited into the imperial army as the Varangian Guard, and were receptive to Orthodox civilization. The Pecheks were much closer to the imperial frontier. So these two people essentially replaced the Khazars as the favored imperial allies. And sometime in 965 or 967, the Rus under their leader Sviatoslav and the Khazars, Pecheneks destroyed the Khazar capital. And the Khazar Khanate fragmented shortly after 965. The Khazars have excited a great deal of imagination, and particularly in various racist and ideological claims and publications of the late 19th and early 20th century. There was an argument that was long voiced that the Ashkenazi Jews, the European Jews, were not really Jews. They weren't really Hebrews. They were nothing more than wayward Khazars who had been converted in the 9th century and became the origins of the Jewish community of Russia, and therefore they really have no claims to being true Jews. Well, this has turned out to be quite a bogus claim in a number of ways, and for me, these claims are generally raised by ideologues who wanted to marginalize or even persecute Jews in Europe. What has been shown by DNA testing is the majority of the Jewish communities across the world have a DNA that confirms what the literary sources have always told us, no surprise to me, that the Jewish communities have a very powerful DNA component that comes out of the Middle East. What happened to the Khazar Jews, they were only the court and a small aristocracy. After the destruction of their Khanate, they probably were absorbed into the later Turkish confederations. And rather than getting involved in all these racist politics of the 20th century, it is better to look at the Khazars for what they had achieved. They had created a great steppe empire based on trade. They had tolerated all the faiths. They had proved immensely successful in defining themselves, and they really provided a model for the next successful rulers of the Western steppes, and that will be the family of Batu, the grandsons of Genghis Khan, the rulers of the Golden Horde.
Lecture 18. Pecheneks, Magyars, and Cumans.
In this lecture, I wish to complete the relationship between the Byzantine world and the nomadic peoples on the Pontic-Caspian steppes. We started the discussion of this topic two lectures ago, and we're going a bit beyond chronologically when we dealt with the Chinese and the steppe nomads, and that's to complete the story, because two important conclusions come out of this lecture. One is that the Byzantines never really achieve a success in absorbing or converting any of these nomadic peoples to Orthodox Christianity and Byzantine civilization. On the other hand, one of the groups that we're going to talk about, the Magyars, will be assimilated into Western Europe and will become essentially